Okay, so the religious beliefs of key American founders. Notice the word key is in here because I put this together. The church put together the one that's on the thing. It doesn't include the word key. And also my book doesn't include the word key because I didn't have control over that one either. That I was lucky to get that much of it. So key is key here because one cannot really accurately say anything about the founding fathers and what they believed because they were like you and I, a bunch of individuals. And they weren't just a conglomerate that all agreed on everything and they sat down and said, what are we going to do about this? You know, what's our favorite football team? So on and so forth. They were individuals and they had distinct views. And so what I'm focusing on today is the guys who I call the key American founders, and there's eight of them for reasons which we'll talk about in a moment. Now, how come I get to do this? Several years ago, Dr. MacArthur came to my office after having read my book, this guy here, on the religious beliefs of the key American founders. He expressed a desire that everyone at Grace Community hear my presentation on the subject. I've done it at a number of churches and other colleges and so forth. As he left my office, he asked for a copy of the handout that you're going to receive a little bit later. I don't want to give it to you now because I'm a professor and I know that if I give you a handout now, you won't pay attention to what I'm saying. You'll be looking at the handout. So the handout will come out later. And he asked for a copy of it. Several fellowship groups allowed me to make this presentation. He also arranged for me to do a seminar at the Shepherd's Conference that year for this, and he also bought a copy of my book for each member of the university's board of directors. So for those of you who need the security blanket of Dr. MacArthur's approval, I've got it. But because there are so many people relatively new to Grace Church, and John wanted everyone to hear it, it's time to do the presentation again. I've done it before several times in Sundays in July, but there's been a lot of turnover, and so that's why we're doing it. Now, let me start with this. Everybody pay attention to this if you don't pay attention to anything else. I feel very blessed to have been born in and to live in the United States. I thank the Lord every night when I pray that I live in the United States and not in some other place. There's no other place in the world I'd want to live. I believe it's the greatest and best country in human history with the best political system ever devised by man. I would not want to live in any other country on earth. But the United States is not perfect. It was created by and is run by fallen people. Regarding religion and the American founding, as you're about to see, my contention is that both the right, wait, you're looking at me, the right and the left are wrong concerning the beliefs of the founders. The left says that most of the founders were deists or rank secularists who intended to completely separate religion from the public sphere, to create a wall of separation between church and state. That is fundamentally false. That is just wrong. There's not a single founder who would have bought into the Supreme Court's wall of separation notion. Not one. The left is wrong. The right says that most of the founders were Christians who based the founding documents on the Bible and intended to create a Christian nation. That is also false. And so we're going to look at what the truth is. Often the truth is somewhere in the middle. And that's the case here. There's not a single founder who said that they intended to create a Christian nation, and not a single founder who said they did create a Christian nation. And you should know that because if there were one, their quote would be emblazoned on the libraries of every Christian school in America. But you don't see it because it isn't there. My desire is for you to see, for the most part, what they themselves said. And that's what we're going to mostly do here. I'm going to show you what they said that they believed. So you don't have to take my word for it. If you don't like it, go to their grave and argue with them. I emphasize what they said in private. what they said in diaries, journals, and personal correspondence with one another, rather than public pronouncements that were made for political purposes. They were, in addition to being great men, they were politicians. And they knew that what you say in public is important, and you shouldn't say unpopular things in public or express unpopular beliefs in public, like I'm doing today. I'm not a politician, so I don't need your votes, so I'm going to tell you the truth and not just what you want to hear. I'm not going to tickle your ears, as the Bible says. So one sees what someone really believes and what they say privately and don't expect the public to see. I apologize in advance that we are going to move very quickly, because this could go on for hours and hours, and we don't have hours and hours. So here we go. Most of what we're going to do is I'm just going to show you what they said and explain to you some things about it and so on. All right? So I wore my plastic suit, but please don't throw rotten fruit. All right, let's begin. First of all, more security blanket. This is a quote by John MacArthur. Rather than acting as resident aliens of a heavenly kingdom, too often we sound and act like resident apologists for a Christian America. Unless we reject the false reliance on the illusion of Christian America, evangelicalism will continue to distort the gospel and thwart a genuine biblical identity. I spoke at a major church for a whole weekend. They had me for 20 hours teaching all about the Christian and politics, teaching my course on the Christian and politics, basically, to them. And at the end of it, I was talking about the fact that we need to place our trust in God, not in, as I did in the prayer a moment ago, we need to place our trust in God, not in processes, not in countries, not in people, etc. And then one lady stood up and said something, and I asked her, well, where's your trust? And she said, it's about, between the United States and God, it's about half and half. And I had to speak to that woman later to share the gospel with her, because if that's your situation, then, well, anyway. Who are the key American founders? Who am I talking about? The people most responsible for the Declaration of Independence, because we're talking about ideas. When you talk about religious beliefs, we're talking about ideas. So who established the ideas behind America? That's the idea. Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin. You've heard of them. Most responsible for the Constitution and explaining it and putting it into effect, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, you've heard of him. You haven't heard of these two, Gouverneur Morris and James Wilson. Let me just say quickly, I don't have to explain to you the first six, why they're important, but I'll tell you the last two. Gouverneur Morris spoke more than anyone else at the Constitutional Convention. James Madison, who is known as the father of the Constitution, said that title rightly belongs to Gouverneur Morris. He was arguably the most influential on the Constitution. He was also the chairman of the Committee on Style that wrote the Constitution. So whereas Madison gets all the credit, Madison said it's really Morris who wrote the Constitution. Then there's James Wilson, also very influential, particularly on the presidency and things like that in the Constitution, and also was an early Supreme Court judge. All right. And these are recognized, generally speaking, as key guys. Last time I went to Washington, D.C., and went to the archives, National Archives, to look at the copy of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution that are there. They have a bunch of documents in there around a semicircle, and with each one, they had a little display of some prominent founder, and the first seven of those were seven of my people. The only one that wasn't there, guess which one wasn't there? No. Benjamin Franklin wasn't there. Morris and Wilson were there. Anyway, all right. So what did John Adams have to say? He's a member of the Declaration Drafting Committee, obviously also President of the United States, ultimately very important in the Revolution. He referred to the deity of Jesus Christ and his satisfaction for the sins of man as absurdity. Now, I've interacted with some people at other institutions that try to say that Adams and Jefferson were Christians, and then later in life, they turned away and so on and so forth. Well, first of all, the theology of this church, we don't believe you can lose your salvation. So, but aside from that, this is when he was in college. So this is not late in his life. Okay? This is from his diary. He said, concerning the Trinity, the Pythagorean as well as the Platonic philosophers probably concurred in the fabrication of the Christian Trinity. Pythagoras, some of you will remember, is famous for working with triangles, threes, right? And so that's why he says along with Platonic philosophers, you're going to see that Jefferson also says the Platonic philosophers created the Trinity, concurred in the fabrication of the Christian Trinity. In other words, he doesn't believe in the Trinity. This is the most outrageous thing that I found in 30 years of researching this. Actually, it's now 40 years, but when I wrote the book, it was 30 years. The most outrageous thing I found. You ready for this? Everybody have a seatbelt on? Adams wrote to Jefferson and said, "Had you and I been 40 days with Moses on Mount Sinai and admitted to behold the divine Shekinah," in other words, God himself, "and they're told that one was three and three one, we might not have had the courage to deny it, but we could not have believed it. We could not have believed the doctrine. We should be more likely to say in our hearts, whatever we might say with our lips, this is chance. There is no God, no truth. This is all delusion, fiction, a lie, or it is all chance." In other words, even if God himself on Mount Sinai told him the Trinity was true, he wouldn't believe it. That's how adamant he was about it. And what about Jesus dying on the cross? Jesus being God and dying on the cross for our sins. An incarnate God, an eternal, self-existent, omnipresent, omniscient author of this stupendous universe suffering on a cross. My soul starts with horror at the idea. It has stupefied the Christian world. It has been the source of almost all the corruptions of Christianity. So Jesus dying on the cross as God for our sins is the source of almost all the corruptions of Christianity. This term, corruptions of Christianity, is very important. It's a reference, he doesn't say so at this particular moment, but it's a reference to Joseph Priestley. Joseph Priestley wrote a two-volume work on the corruptions of Christianity. It could be retitled The Doctrines of Grace Church. Basically, all the fundamental doctrines of Christianity he declared to be corruptions of Christianity, and he was very influential on Adams, on Jefferson, and on Benjamin Franklin. They all refer to him. And when Priestley died, Adams and Jefferson bemoaned the fact that they have other questions that they want to ask, and Priestley would be the only one who could answer them, but he's gone. He says, "We Unitarians..." That is, don't believe in the deity of Christ, don't believe in the Trinity, "one of whom I have had the honor to be for more than 60 years, he says here, which, by the way, again, refutes those who say that he just did it at the end. He said by his own account. And by the way, if you go back 60 years, that's 1756, that's that previous diary entry that I read to you earlier. He said, "65 years ago, my own minister, the Reverend Samuel Bryant and others, were Unitarians." Now, this is important. Because those who promote the Christian American notion rely very, very, very heavily on denominational affiliation. They don't look at what the guys actually said they believe. They just say, "Oh, he was a Presbyterian, therefore he's blah, 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 blah." But as Adams is pointing out, Adams went to a Congregationalist church. That's Calvin, started the Congregationalism. I mean, they base it on Calvin. That's a Reformed church, the doctrine of which matches Grace Church in its origin, but his church was turned Unitarian when he was a young man. So he's listed in other books by friends of mine that I keep arguing with. They keep listing him, you know, as a Reformed Christian and so forth. Well, he's Reformed in that he went to a church that started out as Reformed, but it has totally abandoned Reformed doctrine. And he never embraced Reformed doctrine. What about the Bible? Philosophy, which is the result of reason, is the original revelation of the Creator to his creature, man. No subsequent revelation supported by prophecies or miracles, what's that? The Bible, in other words, can supersede it. And he wrote this, ironically, on Christmas Day. No subsequent revelation supported by prophecies or miracles can supersede philosophy. Philosophy is the key. He said, the Bible is the most Republican book in the world, therefore I will still revere it. Some of you could relate to that. Hopefully not. It's not Republican with a capital R. It's not the party. He will revere it because it's the most Republican book. I don't have time. I'm sorry. You can ask it later. Question time. Then he says, the preamble to the laws of Zaleucus, which were supposedly handed down by the goddess Athena to the Greeks, is as orthodox as Christian theology as Priestley's, who I've already said he identified with Priestley's theology. So the laws of Zaleucus, this pagan document, is for him as orthodox Christian theology as Priestley's. Now this gets to another point. The people who promote the Christian America thing, they note all of the references to Christian that these guys make, but they meant something entirely different by the word Christian than we do. You walk into Grace Church and you talk about this guy says Christian, and you immediately are thinking about fundamental Christian doctrine. That isn't what they meant. And you can see that here. This pagan document is, for him, just as orthodox as Christian theology as Priestley's, who was another guy who was a problem. But anyway, all right, so the word Christian needs to be done in context with what the person saying it means, all right? We're going to see more of that later. He said, where is to be found theology more orthodox or philosophy more profound than in the introduction to the Shastra, which was a Hindu text? These doctrines, sublime if ever there were any sublime, Pythagoras learned in India, taught them to Zaleucus and his other disciples, all ended in heaven if they became virtuous. And here's another key. How do you get to heaven? What's the basis of salvation? It's good works. It's being good. My religion, here we go. My religion is founded upon the love of God and my neighbor in doing the duty of doing no wrong, but all the good I can. I believe, too, in a future state of rewards and punishments, but not eternal. So a number of them believed that there was a hell, but it was temporary. And you would go there, be punished for a while, and then eventually everybody ends up in heaven. But if you want to go straight to heaven and skip it's sort of like the Catholic notion, right? If you want to go straight to heaven and not deal with any of the punishment, then just do good works. He said, I believe that all good men are Christians. That's the bottom line. Placing all religion in grace and its offspring faith is anti-Christianity. Our church is misnamed for John Adams. He said in a letter to his wife, my religion, you know, is not exactly conformable to that of the greatest part of the Christian world. It excludes superstition. A lot of the miracles, a lot of those elements of what the Bible talks about for them were superstition. Some of them they believed in. And we'll get to the ones that why they believed them, what the bottom line is on all of this later. So they believed in some miracles, not in others. What about Thomas Jefferson? Now, Thomas Jefferson has for years been known as an infidel. In fact, that was a key element in the election of 1800. Everybody knew he was an infidel. But lately, some people have tried to sort of resurrect Jefferson's spirituality and whatnot. So he, by the way, is the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, where people find some things that they like, and so it's important to know what he meant when he was writing it. The metaphysical insanities of Athanasius of Loyola and of Calvin are, to my understanding, mere relapses into polytheism. He's talking about the Trinity there, the Trinity. For him, it is polytheism. It's a metaphysical insanity. Athanasius wrote the Trinitarian doctrine, and for Calvin, for Jefferson, he doesn't believe it. It's actually three gods. He says, when we shall have done away the incomprehensible jargon of the Trinitarian arithmetic that three are one and one is three, then we'll be able to move on and get better and so on and so forth. And then he said, the hocus-pocus phantasm of a god like another Cerberus with one body and three heads. That's what he's talking about, the Trinity. The Cerberus in Roman mythology was a three-headed dog, a three-headed hound that guarded the gates to hell. And so for him, the idea of the Trinity is like a Cerberus, a three-headed being of some sort. He's mocking the Trinity, as he was in the other ones as well. As I said, he and Adams completely rejected the Trinity. He said, "In the day, what about the virgin birth? And the day will come when the mystical generation of Jesus, by the supreme being as his father in the womb of a virgin, will be classed with the fable of the generation of Minerva in the brain of Jupiter." So in Roman mythology, Minerva is the child of Jupiter, and Jupiter doesn't want a child, so he swallows the fetus, if you will, and then she gets born anyway. She bursts out of the side of his head. It's a pleasant thought. For Jefferson, that's like the virgin birth is the same type of thing. It's all mythology. It's all hocus pocus. What about the corruptions of Christianity? What about doctrines? To the corruptions of Christianity, I am indeed opposed, but not to the genuine precepts of Jesus himself. I am a Christian in the only sense in which he wished anyone to be, sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others, ascribing to himself every human excellence and believing he never claimed any other. So let's take this apart. There's like 10 things here, but we'll do all three of them. The corruptions of Christianity. There again, that's a reference to Priestley, and we're going to see in just a moment what Jefferson specifies what those corruptions are, and he's just repeating the chapter titles of Priestley's two-volume book on the corruptions of Christianity, the things that priests invented in order to capture people and have a job, basically. But they don't have anything to do with what Jesus said. And that's where he gets to in the next part. He believes that he is a genuine follower of Jesus by following just what the Gospels say. And we'll talk more about that later. And then he says, I am a Christian. And by the way, a number of the Christian American people, all right, so in a couple of these, you've seen I've used ellipses. I've used ellipses, three little dots, right? And you'll see more of those along the way. Three little dots which are used when you're writing to say that there's something else there that you've cut out, all right? And the Christian American people will say, we'll take from Jefferson, they won't do the first part. They'll say, I am a Christian, dot, dot, dot. See, Thomas Jefferson was a Christian. Now, what does he say? He's a Christian in the only sense in which Jesus wished anyone to be, that is, attached to his doctrines in preference to all others, and ascribing to himself every human excellence and believing he never claimed any other. In other words, he didn't claim to be God. Cutting out the parts of what Jesus said about being God, which he literally does later, as we'll see. He lists a number of artificial systems invented by ultra-Christian sects, unauthorized by a single word ever uttered by Jesus. And here's where we get to the corruptions of Christianity. Here he calls them artificial systems invented by ultra-Christian sects. What are they? The Immaculate Conception of Jesus, his deification, the creation of the world by him, his miraculous powers, his resurrection and visible ascension, the Trinity, original sin, atonement, regeneration, election. Now, I have ellipses here, dot, dot, dot. So what I'm cutting out are the Catholic doctrines that he includes. But these are the ones that should relate to us. These are corruptions of Christianity. These are artificial systems that were invented by ultra-Christian sects, according to Jefferson. It's also the Grace Community doctrinal statement. How do we get saved? Jefferson said, "My fundamental principle would be the reverse of Calvin's, that we are to be saved by our good works, which are within our power, and not by our faith, which is not within our power." What about the Bible? Here he's writing to his favorite nephew. "Read the Bible, then, as you would read Livy or Tacitus." Those are Roman historians. "Read the Bible, then, as you would read Livy or Tacitus. Your own reason is the only oracle given you by heaven." Regarding the writers of the New Testament, other than the Gospels, he had respect for the Gospels, sort of, if butchering them shows respect. But anyway, he thought he did. Regarding writers of the New Testament, other than the Gospels, he said, "These pseudo-evangelists pretended to inspiration." So there we're talking about Paul and some other people. What about Paul? He regularly refers to the New Testament other than the Gospels as a dunghill. That is, for those who don't know, a pile of poop. That's what the rest of the New Testament besides the Gospels is, according to Thomas Jefferson. That's a regular thing. That was his favorite term for the rest of the New Testament. What about Paul? "Of this band of dupes and imposters, Paul was the great Corypheus, or leader of the chorus, and first corrupter of the doctrines of Jesus." Guess we shouldn't have read him this morning in the main service. How do you get to heaven? There's not a Quaker or a Baptist, a Presbyterian or an Episcopalian, a Catholic or a Protestant in heaven. On entering that gate, we leave those badges of schism, of division, behind and find ourselves united in those principles only in which God has united us all. Let us not be uneasy then about the different roads we may pursue to that our last abode, but let us be happy in the hope that by these different paths, we shall all meet in the end. Everybody goes to heaven. These other things, these other titles are just dividing things in this world, and we need to cast those aside because they're going to be cast aside eventually. And there are many roads to heaven. This is another fundamental belief of these key founders. There's many roads to heaven. He said, "I believe that he who steadily observes those moral precepts in which all religions concur will never be questioned at the gates of heaven as to the dogmas in which they all differ." The key founders had no room for doctrine. It was dividing. And religion's importance, the key importance of religion, was to provide morality for society. You have they're creating a free society without a king or any kind of iron fist at the top. How do you get people to be good? How do you get them to obey? Morality. How do you get morality? Religion. Benjamin Franklin, I don't have this on here, but Benjamin Franklin once said that he had no use for a certain Presbyterian minister because he kept talking about the Bible rather than teaching people to be good citizens. And that, for them, was the purpose of religion. So what about Benjamin Franklin? I'm not going to do very much with him because it's pretty obvious, but nonetheless. This is, I think, if it's the first one, I think it is the saddest thing I uncovered in 30 years of research. Here it is, the saddest thing I uncovered in 30 years. This is like 2 months before Franklin dies, okay? He says this, "As to Jesus of Nazareth, my opinion of whom you particularly desire, I think the system of morals and his religion as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is likely to see. But I apprehend it has received various corrupting changes, and I have doubts as to his divinity. Though it is a question I do not dogmatize upon, having never studied it, and I think it needless to busy myself with it now when I expect soon an opportunity of knowing the truth with less trouble. I see no harm, however, in its being believed if that belief has the good consequences of making his doctrines more respected and better observed. All right, so let's break down a few things here. Jesus of Nazareth. This is the way they regularly referred to Jesus, either just Jesus or Jesus of Nazareth, because that emphasizes his humanity. Not Jesus Christ, but Jesus of Nazareth emphasizes humanity. And morals, again, that's the whole key. Notice corrupting changes, the reference to corruption, the corrupting doctrines of Christianity from that perspective. Then he says, I have doubts as to his... Now, he's writing to a minister. He's writing to a Christian minister who wrote to him to ask him what he thought about Jesus specifically. And so he writes in polite 18. In other words, I don't believe it. That's trust me, you read enough 18th century stuff. That's what they would say if they respected the person they were responding to and they disagreed with them, they would say, I have doubts concerning that. So he respects Ezra Stiles, and he then writes it this way. But it means he doesn't believe in it. And then he says, of course, I think it needless to busy myself with it now. He knows he's going to die soon, and so he'll find out the truth with less trouble. And he certainly did, unfortunately. He said, all sects have experienced my goodwill in a... church, hopefully all of you do. Franklin was famous for giving to all the churches in Philadelphia. And he also helped to build a new church building that was specifically set up for people who the churches wouldn't let preach, to give them a place to preach. And guess who the first person to preach was? Priestley. He's never opposed any of their doctrines because he's not into doctrine. He doesn't have any doctrines. The same thing with the others, which, by the way, is why we have freedom of religion in America. If we had more time, I could go down that road with you. But the reason that they allowed freedom of religion is because they didn't have a dog in the race. They didn't care what doctrines. All religions, from their perspective, taught morality. All right. Let's have a little quiz here. Identify the Christian president. President A was a Baptist. President B, Episcopalian. President A claimed to be a Christian. President B never claimed to be a Christian. President A took communion publicly and actually got in trouble for it from one case. President B refused to take communion and was publicly chastised by the minister of his church for his bad example. President A had an advisory council of evangelical ministers. President B's advisors denied the fundamentals of Christianity. Anybody want to guess A or B? So let's turn to the 500-pound gorilla in the room, George Washington, the most fought over between the two camps, the secular and the Christian America camps, George Washington. By the way, let me just do a disclaimer again, and a couple people in here can attest to this because they've seen it. I have a list of the 10 greatest Americans. I'm a list person. I have a list for everything. I have my 10 favorite statistics. I have a list for everything. My list of the 10 greatest Americans, George Washington is numbers 1 through 5. Because there are really 5 George Washingtons. There's 5. Washington. That's not my thing. I'm just trying to tell you the truth. It's his fault. What did George Washington believe? Washington's writings. He never claims to be a Christian. On March 3rd, 1797, a group of clergymen tried to get him to affirm whether he was a Christian or not. They came up with a plot to try and trick him into declaring whether or not he was a Christian. But they were frustrated when Washington refused to do so, and one of them said, "The old fox was too cunning for us." He wouldn't say. Washington never took communion. And after being publicly chastised for his bad example by James Abercrombie, who I want to meet in heaven, that guy had hair, to stand up in front of his congregation and criticize George Washington. After being publicly chastised for his bad example, he never again attended a sacrament Sunday. This is according to his granddaughter, Nellie Custis, who lived with the Washingtons and who sometimes went home with George and sometimes stayed with Martha. Martha stayed for communion. George didn't. Bishop William White, the overseer of the local churches, and Dr. James Abercrombie, the assistant rector of Washington's church and the chastiser. After chastising him, Washington sent him a nice letter apologizing and said that I won't give a bad example anymore, and then he just didn't come. He spoke of Christians in the third person. He said, "Being no bigot myself to any mode of worship, I am disposed to indulge the professors of Christianity, that road to heaven which to them shall seem the most direct, plainest, easiest, and least liable to exception." All right, now let's break this down. First of all, he says, being no bigot. In our world today, if you're a bigot, it means you hate black people or you hate Jews or you're somebody. That isn't what it meant in the 18th century. It just meant you had a firm conviction about something. You had a side. I am a Green Bay Packers fan. And that I'm a bigot when it comes to pro football teams. I have a choice. Okay? I have a horse in the race. That's all that means. So he says, I don't have any particular mode of worship. It doesn't matter to me. And the professors of Christianity doesn't mean professor like me. I'm a professor at the Master's University. But it means people who profess something. So he's exposed to allow the people who profess Christianity, that road to heaven, various roads to heaven, that road to heaven which to them seems the best and so on and so forth. He studiously avoided mentioning the name of Jesus. In 20,000 plus pages of his writings, there's only one reference to Jesus Christ, or Christ, and that is not in his handwriting and not accepted as Washington's by the Smithsonian or the Washington Papers Project. It was by one of his aides. He had an aide during the American Revolution who was a Christian and sometimes put Christian or at least semi-Christian language into things, and we're going to see another example of that in a moment. Washington always used God words, that's what I call them, God words, in place of any term specific to Christianity, the Bible, or any other religion. And that's what all of these key American founders, not all American founders, again, oh, by the way, I didn't mention, there are Christians among the founding fathers. Sorry, I meant to mention that. There are no deists among the founding fathers until you get down the list to like 100 or so. If you start listing founders and you get down to about 100 or so, then you've got two deists in there. So there are no deists. There are Christians among the founders. In fact, if I had written a book with 9 founding fathers, the 9th one was a Christian. The one I would say was 9th most important was a Christian. So there were Christians. But all these eight, these key founders, and I think there's a division between my eight and the ninth one, which is why he's not there. But anyway, aside from that, they used God words. They didn't use biblical terms for God. They used things like hand, invisible hand, or author, or governing force, or supreme governor, or things like that. God words. For example, and this will point out his aide, too, who is a Christian. In a speech to Indian leaders written by a clerk, that clerk, he crossed out the word God and substituted the great spirit above. So his clerk had written a speech to Indian leaders and talked about God. Washington scratched it out and in his own handwriting substituted the great spirit above, because that was their concept of God, and that's okay with Washington, because any road, there's many roads, and that God and this God and that God, it's all the same. His use of God words and his belief that all roads lead to God are best understood when one remembers that Washington was an enthusiastic Freemason. He laid the Capitol building cornerstone. You see the Capitol building where Congress sits? He laid that cornerstone, and he did it in a Masonic apron with a Masonic trowel at the head of a Masonic parade. His favorite portrait of himself is in his Masonic regalia. You've no doubt seen that portrait when he's dressed up really, quote, nicely, end quote. And there's a George Washington Masonic Memorial, including his chair that he sat in as master of the Alexandria Lodge. Now, before we get no one at the end today, come up to me or ask when we ask, if we hopefully we have question time, nobody try to tell me that the Masons, that this Masonic conspiracy, don't do that. Just, I've heard it all. I know the dollar bill. I know this, that, blah, 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 all that stuff. It's a bunch of balagna. So don't do it. It's a waste of time. So the fact that Washington was a Mason and so was Franklin is important, but they weren't part of a conspiracy. But it nonetheless is important because of what Masons believed. Freemasonry holds to a unitary supreme being, the so-called great architect of the universe, one of these God words, denies Christ's unique saviorship and atonement, reduces religion to a moralistic observance of allegedly common ethical principles, all meet together, pray, worship together to the same one and only indivisible God whom all religions acknowledge and venerate. That's a really good description of what these guys believed in terms of God. We already saw some of it in Adams and Jefferson. Although those two weren't Masons, but nonetheless, that's the view. He also steadfastly refused to kneel in prayer. And you're saying, well, I don't always kneel in prayer either. We don't have kneeling benches in our church. Well, his church did, because that was the custom. That was what people did. They knelt in prayer. And Washington was the one who, when everybody else was kneeling, was the tallest guy in the room, and he was on his feet. He was 6'3", which was hugely tall for his day. The average male was about 5'5", in his day. One of the reasons why Washington stuck out, as well as Jefferson, he was 6'3", as well. John Adams was 5'6", and I think James Madison was 5'4". So he steadfastly refused to kneel. Okay, so what's the big deal? There's another thing that matters to this, okay? And that is the very famous portrait that many of you have seen of Washington kneeling in prayer at Valley Forge. The man who was supposed to have found Washington kneeling in prayer at Valley Forge, Isaac Potts, a farmer named Isaac Potts, was nowhere near Valley Forge in 1777 by his own reckoning. He moved there near the end of the war. This is one of many things about Washington that were created by Parson Weems. Mason Locke Weems, or Parson Weems, wrote a hagiography of Washington when he died. Do you know what a hagiography is? Probably not. You know what a biography is, a book about somebody's life? A hagiography is a book about somebody's life that blows them up beyond what their actual importance. It makes them to be a lot more important and better and so on than they really were, okay? So Weems, when Washington died, saw a way to capitalize and make some money, and he did, and he wrote this hagiography, and much of the Washington stuff comes from that. It just made up by Mason Locke Weems. Like, I'm sorry, plug your ears if you don't want to hear it. Like the cherry tree story. There's no evidence for that actually happening. That's a Mason Locke Weems creation. My favorite one is Washington throwing a silver dollar across the Potomac. When my wife and I went to Mount Vernon, I carried a silver dollar with me on purpose when we traveled across the country to Mount Vernon. We went to Mount Vernon. I stood on the shore of the Potomac River, which is right in front of Mount Vernon, and I posed like this, and my wife took a photo of it to show me about to throw a silver dollar a mile, which is the width of the Potomac at that point. But it has a base. Many of the Mason Locke Weems stories have some basis, in fact. What happened was, when Washington was a young man, he and another guy were fighting over a young woman. Her affections, not fighting, but, you know, competing for a young woman's affections. And he bet the other guy that he could skip a rock across the Rappahannock River, which was about 100 yards across. He bet him he could skip a rock across 100 yards, the Rappahannock, and that turns into throwing a silver dollar across the Potomac in Mason Locke Weems. One other reference to that, because I just can't. I have to do it. We went upstairs to the bedroom where Washington died, and everybody's looking at the bed, and everybody's sort of, you know, meditating and stuff. Here's the bed in which George Washington died. I've already told you, I think Washington is the greatest American, right? But I'm looking at the ceiling, and my wife said, "What are you doing? Why are you looking at the ceiling?" I said, "I'm looking, and I'm amazed at how well they patched the ceiling, because Mason Locke Weems said the angels came down and pulled him up." So a lot of the stories about Washington are Mason Locke Weems stories. You know, the Indians all tried to shoot Washington, and none of them could, and so on and so forth. Anyway, this one, kneeling prayer at Valley Forge, didn't happen. First of all, he never knelt in prayer to begin with, and why he'd do it in the snow, I don't know. But aside from that, the guy who Mason Locke Weems said told him, Isaac Potts, says he was never there. All right. What did his ministers say upon his death? Now, they have nothing to gain by sullying the reputation of the great Washington, right? Bishop White, who was head of the overseer of the churches, "I do not believe that any degree of recollection will bring to my mind any fact which would prove General Washington to have been a believer in the Christian revelation." Reverend Samuel Miller, who was the actual minister of his church, "How is it possible for a true Christian to die without one expression of distinctive belief or Christian hope? Why should we believe Washington was a Christian? What's the evidence for such an idea?" Michael Novak, a number of years ago, wrote a book called Washington's God, and his purpose for the book was to show that Washington was a Christian, and here's how he concludes his book. Now remember, his purpose was to show that Washington was a Christian. At the end, he says this: "Overpowering evidence for his commitment to a full-dress Christianity," whatever that is, maybe that's, you know, a three-piece suit, I don't know, "a full-dress Christianity is not to be found in the printed record. That he was a very good man in his moral life, stayed well within the bounds of Christian moral imperatives, and fulfilled a very high measure of nearly all Christian virtues is testified to by many witnesses." So if your definition of Christian is their definition of Christian, then he was a Christian. But if your definition is something that includes, I don't know, embracing the gospel, then not so much. In fact, he goes on to say, still, the stated beliefs Washington lived by fell rather short of the full Christian creed. To confess the latter would have required very little of him, yet he evaded the many invitations offered him in public and in private to do so. So let's talk about defining the terms. There's a gentleman, a fine gentleman, he's a very nice guy, I debated him on the radio, and we remain friends, and he's a very nice guy, and he in his book says there's two contexts for what it means to be a Christian. He says the term Christian can be used in two contexts. First, it can describe someone who is born again or saved or regenerate, a dedicated follower of Jesus Christ and his teachings. You like that one? All right. But there's another one. The term Christian is also loosely used to denote a person whose beliefs about God, the world, and man are generally in accord with those of the Christian religion, but who may not be a dedicated follower of Christ. Now, this is in the beginning of a book in which he is making the case for the founding fathers being Christians. And then he says this, and I believe this guy's a Christian. You don't know who it is, but just in case you do, I believe he's a Christian, okay? But then he says this, in this second context, a person's beliefs, actions, and or demeanor may be Christian, that is decent, generous, and moral, but he or she might not be regenerate. In the chapters which follow, the term is used primarily in this latter sense. And now, the founding fathers. So in his book, he at least admits that he is using this latter term, that they were decent, generous, and moral, that they were good people. And then he's going to claim that they are Christians in that sense. And then he goes through the founding fathers. So that I include that because definitions matter. In my book, the very first two pages are my definitions and my presuppositions. Everybody has presuppositions. They just don't usually admit them. I admit mine. These are my fundamental presupposition is that people will say in private what they really believe, as opposed to in public. So this is actually not the conclusion, but it's the conclusion of this part. So if those of you who are thinking, man, I'll get to lunch early, we're not done. But here's a key conclusion. The key founders were religious men, but not Christians. They believed religion was extremely important, indeed critical to the health of a free society, but not necessarily Christianity. And by the way, the Christian American people, one of their favorite things to do is to say, when anybody said the word religion or religious back then, they meant Christian. That's just not true. Jefferson and Adams went back and forth on Hinduism and all these other things. Anyway, it's just not true. And sometimes they'll give quotes to prove that, and in the quote, that quote will distinguish between Christian and other religions. And I'm just going, you can't read your own writing? It's just not true that religion meant Christianity. They believed religion and morality were fundamental pillars of society. That's exactly what Washington says in his farewell address. Religion and morality, that was a key phrase that was connected together, religion and morality, because that for them was the purpose of religion. The value of religion was to produce morality. And Washington over and over said, or in the federal farewell address said, religion and morality are the pillars of society. And he also said, no one can claim to be a patriot if they do anything to harm religion or morality. But virtually any religion would serve the purpose, because all the religions they knew about produced morality. So I've got Alexander Hamilton here as one of these guys, right? But there's two Alexander Hamiltons. The Alexander Hamilton when he was in power, which is one of these guys that believes this. And then there's Alexander Hamilton on his last day of life. Alexander Hamilton, during his period when he was in power, said this, talking about a certain preacher. He is just what I should like for a military parson, except he does not whore or drink. And later, he will not insist upon your going to heaven, whether you will or not. His wife was a Christian. Hamilton's wife was a Christian, and she kept trying to work on him throughout their marriage and didn't succeed until the end. He did not speak of Christ during all that time. He used God words such as supreme intelligence, omnipotence, benefactor. These are more of these God words. He equated God with nature. That sounds familiar. Nature is God, yeah. Even though he didn't write that. What about Hamilton the Christian? So Hamilton famously fought a duel with Aaron Burr. Some people know about it because of a commercial that came out a few years ago. But Hamilton was killed in a duel with Aaron Burr. And when Burr shot him, he lived for another couple of days, writhing in agony. And when he was lying on what he knew was his deathbed, he asked them to send for a minister to give him communion before he died. So they sent for a minister who refused to give him communion because he didn't believe he was a Christian. I want to meet that guy in heaven too. Refused Alexander Hamilton communion on his deathbed because you're not a Christian. So he left. So Hamilton said, get somebody else. So they called another minister who came, and he refused to give him communion because his church would only do communion with everybody, not individual communion. So Hamilton says, call the first guy back. So the first guy comes back, and Hamilton proceeds to prove to him that he's actually a believer. And the minister records the whole thing. It's in the newspaper, his account, and all of the people who were standing around confirmed this account of what Hamilton said. And he didn't talk about supreme intelligence, omnipotence, and benefactor. Here's what Hamilton said on his deathbed. And this excites me because Hamilton's my favorite founding father. I have a list. He's my favorite. He's not the greatest, but he's my favorite. Here's what he said. He placed his hope for the next life in redeeming grace and divine mercy. He said, I'm a sinner. I look to his mercy. I have a tender reliance on the mercy of the Almighty through the merits of the Lord Jesus Christ. It's a slight difference than some of the other things we've been seeing, right? And then he sought and took communion on his deathbed. A key to this is, what did they mean by Christian? Christian America advocates take the use of the words Christian or Christianity at face value, quote them to evangelical born-again Christians, despite the fact that the person being quoted meant something entirely different than the audience understands by those terms, as we've been showing. Adams, Jefferson, Franklin, and others had their own definitions of Christianity, which rejected virtually all of the core doctrines of Christianity. All right, so let's look at the founding documents. The Declaration of Independence. One of the things you should think about, before I even get into it, one of the things you should think about is everybody embraces the Declaration of Independence and believes that it shows their side. Christians say, see, that Jefferson was a Christian. Look at this Christian language. And secularists say, see, it's all secularists. It's God of nature. Nature's God. Jefferson was so brilliant. He wrote it artfully, as I say in my book. He wrote it artfully to appeal to everybody, so everybody was on board. Deists embraced it. Christians embraced it. Secularists embraced it. Because it uses generic God words, not biblical terms. The only biblical term in the Declaration of Independence for God is the term creator. And everybody believed there was a creator in those days because it was before Darwin. So deists believed in a creator. Even secularists believed that there was a creator because it doesn't make any sense that it could just happen out of nothing. Right? So all of these rational people, there must be a creator. But that's the only biblical term. The emphasis is on reason. Notice he appeals to self-evident truths, not revealed truths, self-evident truths. In your own reason, these are things that you should know are true. They're not revealed truths. And on nature. So he artfully appeals to rationalists and to the more conventionally religious. It's acceptable to religious sensibilities of everybody. Why are people of all faiths and secularists equally comfortable with it? It's subject to varied interpretation. Christians read Christian content into it. And it's actually an honest expression of the political theology undergirding the American experiment, which is what we're going to talk about in a minute. It's the actual their actual belief system. It reflects it very well. What about the U.S. Constitution? First of all, it's godless. One of the complaints about it in the ratification debates in the various 13 states was that it didn't mention God. That was a complaint in two of the states. There's little reference to God in the Constitutional Convention, none to the Bible. Constitutional Convention, the months that they went through, we have it all written down, and they don't mention the Bible at all. There's very little reference to God, and some of that's not the God that you would think of. It's like the ancient Greek God and so forth. There's no quotations on any principles. Sometimes they used quotations that were Christian to illustrate a principle, but not for the principle itself. There's no mention of the Bible in the Federalist Papers, 85 essays written by predominantly by James Madison and Alexander Hamilton to explain the Constitution and its origin and what their ideas and principles and sources and so forth were. There's no mention of the Bible, not one. God is mentioned twice, and one of those is the Greek God. He's a Greek God from ancient Greece. There are God words five times in the Federalist Papers and 85 essays, never regarding any principle or influence. And as I said earlier, they could afford to grant freedom of religion because they were indifferent toward particular sects or doctrines. So it was really established. We say there's no establishment of religion. It really established their religion. That's what I believe, but that doesn't matter. What about specifics? Constitution includes a no religious test clause, which is easy for those with no freedom. Madison believed that the one religious thing in the Constitution was a requirement for the people to take office to take an oath of office, to take an oath. Because in those days, oaths meant something. People cared about oaths because God would punish them if they didn't fulfill their oath. I know that sounds ludicrous today, but in those days it mattered. The Sunday's accepted phrase. Some people make a lot out of the fact that they said that when Congress puts a bill on the president's desk, he has 10 days to decide whether or not to sign it or veto it. Sunday's accepted. In other words, they skip Sunday. They don't count that in the 10 days. People say, hey, they were Christians. No, it's just a recognition of the reality that most people would not conduct business on Sundays. I'm old enough to remember blue laws. I lived in Missouri, and in my lifetime, when they had a law that no businesses could be open on Sundays except for hospitals and something else emergency-wise. And it was just a thing. People took a day off. It's a day of rest, and it doesn't mean anything religious at all. There's no indication of any significant meaning to it. In any of the 13 states all had ratification conventions. They never mentioned it. They didn't mention it in the Constitutional Convention. They didn't talk about any significance to it. It was just accepted in their culture that you didn't do things on Sunday. And then in the year of our Lord, that was the common means of identifying the year. And all throughout Europe and everywhere, that's what they did. There was no indication of significant meaning. I went through all of the ratification debate documents, and nobody ever said that this had any significance as far as Christianity or whatever. It's just that was the way the dates were put. Why is the Christian America idea popular? First of all, those who promote it are not historians. In fact, they make fun of historians. The most prominent of them is David Barton. Some of you may have seen some of his stuff. I'm going to do some more things that are going to be critical of stuff that he says. I'm not on a campaign to attack David Barton or whatever. It's just he's the loudest voice, and I have to answer the thing. Three times people have tried to arrange a debate between me and David Barton, including his scheduler, and he won't do it. I was told by his former best friend, who was no longer his best friend because he started seeing that a lot of what he was doing was not right, that he won't go anywhere where he's not in charge. So, whatever. But he's not a historian. He has a bachelor's degree in Christian education. And he makes fun of people who have degrees. All right. They're self-professed historians making a profit. David Barton's made millions of dollars off of the Christian America thing. And he's been given a whole bunch of documents that if he sold them would be worth millions and millions of dollars. Or else they are lawyers. The guy who's, I quoted some of, where I said he has the two definitions of Christianity, he's a lawyer. And what's a lawyer's job? To present both sides evenly? No, a lawyer's job is to present one side and win. And so that's part of the problem. And then pastors just trust the other guys and copy what they say. They don't have time. If they're doing a good job as pastors, they don't have time to investigate all of this stuff. Human nature wants us to believe that our nation is specially blessed by God. The Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor for their God Emperor. The Romans cut out the middleman and made their emperor God. Great civilizations want to believe that God or the gods have specially blessed them. And the United States, I would argue, is the greatest civilization in American history, and so it's natural that people would think that God had particularly and specially blessed them. And he has specifically blessed America. But that doesn't mean that it was created by Christians to be a Christian nation. It just means that God chooses to bless people. He blessed Sparta, which was one of the most godless societies in the history of the world, for 800 years. We've got another. We're celebrating 250. We got another 550 to go to match Sparta. And it's easier to call people back to their heritage than to call them to something new and radical. Christianity is radical. It's radical. It's easier to call people back to something that they supposedly had before. Oh, and then there's frustration with public school teaching. I always view it this way. It's like people think there's a tug of war, right? And you got a rag in the middle and you got a rope and people are tugging on both ends and you want to try and get the rag on your side. So the public school's teaching this, so we're going to teach this and it'll help to pull. No, just teach the rag. That's my view. Just teach the rag. Creating quotes. How do the Christian American people get a lot of their evidence? On page 120 of The Myth of Separation by David Barton, James Madison is quoted as saying, religion, ... is, bracket, the basis and foundation of government. Here's the original. This is what Madison actually said. Now, if you follow the yellow, you'll find the quote that Barton gave. And you'll find out that he isn't actually saying that religion is the basis and foundation of government. He's saying that the Declaration of Rights is the basis of foundation of government. But if you carve it up nicely, then you can produce whatever you want. The king of ellipses, that's what I call him. He can't make his argument without ellipses. Quotes out of context, and it's not just him. Quotes as presented. John Adams said, the general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were, ... the general principles of Christianity. I just saw this one again a couple of weeks ago. A woman, bless her heart, from the Federalist repeated this and said, you know, it's clear that they were Christians and whatnot. Well, here's the original of this. In the actual quote, Adams listed the types of men who brought about independence, including Roman Catholics, Universalists, Arians, Socinians. Arians and Socinians don't believe in the Trinity. Deists and atheists and Protestants who believe nothing. And then he said, the general principles on which the founders achieved independence were, and then dot, 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 the only principles in which that beautiful assembly of young men could unite. And what were these general principles? I answer, the general principles of Christianity in which all those sects were united. Are all those sects united in principles of Christianity? Atheists, Zeists, Protestants who believe nothing? And then he went on to claim that he could fill sheets of quotations in favor of these principles with statements from a number of well-known sources, including two very notorious atheists, David Hume and Voltaire. Because it's not Christianity that they're talking about when he says Christian, general principles of Christianity. It's his notion of Christianity. Letter from John Adams. This was a favorite thing that David, again, I'm sorry to David Martin, that a few years ago he had he was given an original copy of this. He had laminated and he'd go to churches and he'd hold it up and then he'd read it. A portion of the 1809 letter is read in which Adams says glowing things about the Holy Spirit, concluding with, there is no authority, civil or religious. There can be no legitimate government but what is administered by this Holy Ghost. Okay. Settles it. I guess we were a Christian nation. Oh, wait. The very next paragraph. Right after the rapturous statements about the Holy Spirit, Adam says, although this is all artifice and cunning, yet they all believe it so sincerely that they would lay down their lives under the axe or the fiery faggot for it. Alas, poor, weak, ignorant dupe, human nature. Do you wonder that Voltaire and Paine, notorious infidels, have made proselytes? And then he tells Benjamin Rush, the guy he wrote the letter to burn it. There were oftentimes Jefferson went to a widow after one of his friends died to get his letters back from him because he didn't want them to get out in the public, didn't want the public to know. Adams doesn't want the public to know that he's saying that people who believe this about the Holy Spirit, that it's all artifice and cunning. They're weak, ignorant dupes. False quotes. Many of the quotes you might receive in an email are bogus or falsely attributed, including Madison on the Ten Commandments, Franklin on spreading the principles of Christianity, Jefferson extolling Christianity, and Patrick Henry on a Christian founding. David Barton actually was forced to admit this on his own website at one point. So, general all-inclusive statements are routinely made, starting with the founders said, the founders believed, the founders wanted, and continual references to they. But the founders were a diverse group of individuals who had various views about politics, religion, law, society, and everything else. The only thing you can legitimately say the founders is just the Constitution. they agreed on that, and actually not all of them. Some of them didn't sign it, and some of them left home. But anyway, most of them did. Who counts as a founding father? This is another key thing. Who are you talking about? Christian America advocates seem to count anyone living at the time of the Revolution or the writing of the Constitution or within 50 or 60 years of those times as a founding father. For example, the American Tract Society, they say, was started by the founding fathers. It was started in 1825, 36 years after the founding. No one listed as a society founder signed the Declaration or Constitution or played a significant role in the founding. Few of them were alive at this point. He talks about a court case, Vidal versus Girard, and says it was in the time of the founders. It was 1844. The last living framer, Thomas Jefferson, died in 1836. I'm just looking at some of the types of evidence because I have a whole other presentation which is all about the evidence and they didn't give me two sessions. So, claim, 52 of the 55 delegates to the Constitutional Convention were Orthodox evangelical Christians. What's the evidence for that? Which, by the way, David Barton lists this as the evidence for it. Okay? The only evidence is a table of contents listing denominational affiliations. I have a copy of it here if you want to see it. It's just a book a guy wrote in which he lists all the founders and then puts their denominational affiliation next to their name. That's it. That's the evidence for 52 of the 55. And to get to 52, you have to count the two Roman Catholics. 84% of today's Congress meets this standard, so what's the problem? 84% of today's Congress lists one of these denominations or Roman Catholicism as their, and so why are we upset? Irrelevant evidence. The Pilgrims and Puritans, you've no doubt heard this a lot made of them. First of all, why them? It wasn't the first colony. It wasn't the largest colony. So why are they the ones who supposedly represent all that America is all about? It's 160 years before the founding. Now think about, okay, this is, what, 2026. Think about 1866. How much in your life is connected with 1866? How much of our society is like 1866? Did they have transgender stuff and everything going on in 1866? This is 160 years before the founding. And their original vision was dead by 1700. They were engaged in the slave trade, rum production, and Indian massacres before 1700. They were part of what was called a triangle trade system. Used to be taught that in school. Not anymore. They were the descendants of the Puritans in New England were engaged in what's called a triangle trade system in which they made rum, sailed to Africa, traded rum for slaves, brought the slaves to South Carolina, where they traded them for more molasses to make rum, and then sailed back up and made rum. This is how they made their profit, the sons and grandsons of the original Pilgrims. That was all gone by 1700, long before the founding. Eight colonies had no religious element whatsoever. In fact, Georgia was started largely as a prison colony. Two of them were founded by dissenters from the Puritans, another by Catholics, another by Quakers. Misrepresentations, and there's a whole list of things under each of these categories. I'm just giving an example. Misrepresentations. Christian America advocates regularly and routinely take quotations that refer to religion or religious and substitute the word Christianity or Christian when they cite them. I mentioned that before. Here's a claim. Right after the Declaration, the Continental Congress voted to purchase 20,000 copies of the Bible for the people of America. The fact is, the matter was tabled and no final action was taken. Barton eventually corrected this also. Another claim. In 1782, Congress voted to endorse and provide financial backing for the Aitken Bible. The fact is, they endorsed it, but they didn't provide any money, and they endorsed it to benefit Aitken, not the Bible. Aitken was the printer who printed all of their materials. And so to help him financially, they endorsed, but they didn't provide any money. They did it for his benefit, not because it was the Bible. Another claim, a study showed that the highest percentage of citations during the founding period were from the Bible, 34%. And another 60% came from men who used the Bible to write their conclusions, so 94% of the quotes of the founders were based on the Bible. I have that study here, by the way, for anybody who wants to check what I'm about to say. Neither the 60% nor the 94% numbers were in the study. Those are Barton numbers. The study is careful to note reprinted sermons accounted for almost three-fourths of the biblical citations, making the non-sermon source of the biblical citations roughly 10%. And he's made this claim in connection with the Constitution. The study says this about the Constitution. I hope I put it here. I did. This 94% claim is specifically made to show the Bible's influence on the Constitution. But the study says that during the debate on the U.S. Constitution, the Bible's prominence disappears. And the debate surrounding the adoption of the Constitution was fought out mainly in the context of Montesquieu, Blackstone, the English Whigs, and the major writers of the Enlightenment. Even at that, the percentages are misleading in this study because misapplication, misuse, and misinterpretation of passages, abuse of the Bible, are counted the same as proper use. It's just they just counted how many times the Bible was cited, but a lot of it was improperly cited, which I could give you several examples of that would amuse you, the way they use the Bible. And we need to remember Satan quotes the Bible too, but that doesn't indicate any righteousness or interest in promoting Christianity on his part. Early pronouncements. In a state case, one of the things that another favorite of Christian American people is when they do court stuff, it's they mix state and Supreme Court together to make it sound like they're all the same. But they're not. Only Supreme Court matters, other than for a state. In a state case in Maryland, Runkle versus Weinmiller, the Supreme Court of Maryland declared that America was a Christian nation in 1796. That same year, the Congress of the United States passed the Treaty of Tripoli, a year later, which says specifically, the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. This was ratified in the Senate without a single dissenting vote, without protest, and was signed by President John Adams and two signers of from the Constitutional Convention. And treaties are part of the supreme law of the land. So it's officially the supreme law of the land. Oh, I didn't move more. All right. I got to the end. Does that mess it up? I can't go back. I tried to pick out a few things from the other presentation. Yeah, okay. So, to read more, there's my book. One guy in here has read my book. He can tell you whether he likes it or not. The Search for Christian America, the OP there means it's out of print. If you go to a used book site like ABE Books, Abe Books, they have used books. I would recommend it. Mark Knoll, Nathan Hatch, and George Marsden. Mark Knoll is considered sort of the elite Christian historian. He had blurbed my book. The little star there is for homeschoolers. I actually was the content editor for that American history book, American Republic, by Bob Jones University Press. It's an eighth grade U.S. history book. People always ask me, homeschoolers always ask me, where can we get, real, and I was used to just say, and I'll say it again, get an American history textbook that was written before 1980. That was before the multiculturalists tried to do their thing and Christian American people we used to just learn American history back in, especially maybe before 1976. Go back there and get a used book and do American history that way. Or this one. They didn't make all the changes that I said, but I think they did most of them. So, all right. So there's a whole lot of other stuff that I could talk about. Questions? It's not in my book. I don't talk about it in my book. So Republican is small r there. It means a Republican form of government, okay? Which the United States is a republic. It's not a democracy. The framers would go nuts if they heard everybody calling it democracy. Read Federalist 10 when Adams rips. Anyway. Okay, so the United States is a republic, which means ruled by representatives of the people, elected by the people. And from Adam's perspective, the Bible illustrates that principle of freedom. Freedom, and he also absorbs some of the things, this is bogus as well, but he absorbs some of the ideas that the Israelite Commonwealth was a republic. and that they elected their leaders. The Bible sort of says that God chose Moses and some of these people, but again, this is another thing that Christian America people will do too. There's one book was written which talks about Israel, the Great Republic, or something like that. Anyway, so there's an argument made that the Israelite Commonwealth was a republic, and Adams was tapping into that idea. Mostly freedom, though.
Thanks. Hey, Doc, what's up? So for John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, what was kind of their, I guess, underlying authority of sorts behind their Unitarian worldview? Like, what kind of drove it? Because hearing them talk about the Bible, Hindu scriptures, and the other ones, saying how they all have kind of common themes seems to contradict what you expect from someone who's studying primary ancient texts without too much other distraction all the time. So kind of what was like, what drove this kind of their worldview?
Yeah, so this is another thing. I have a chapter also in my book about the patriot preachers who promoted the American Revolution during the Revolution, and the bulk of them were not Christians. They were preachers, I know, but they weren't Christians, like some guy in Houston. They went to Harvard mostly, and the people and congregations started complaining about Harvard because the ministers that they had didn't believe the gospel and didn't believe in Christianity. So they complained and complained. That was the origin of Yale. Most people don't know that. The reason Yale was started was because of complaints of the ministers that people were getting from Harvard. So they started Yale, and within 10 years, Harvard went down the toilet. I mean, Yale went down the toilet also. But they were taught rationalism, right? So I can't believe I didn't have that slide on here, but I do have my handout, which now's a good time for it. Jake, thank you. Maybe somebody can help him. In my book, I coin a new term for what they believed, for their religion. A number of authors, there's a whole bunch of books I can point to. The authors have always sort of talked about this, but they never identified what it was. They always said it was deism or Christianity or some mixture of it. So I coined a term called theistic rationalism. Theistic rationalism. They were not deists, they were theists, because they believed in a present God. They believed that prayer mattered because God is present. He's not on vacation or gone to another planet or whatever. And theistic, they were theistic, and they were rationalist. So theistic rationalism combines three elements. It combines Christianity, natural religion or deism, and reason. And they believed that those three streams would take you to the same place most of the time, but when they diverged, you go with reason. Reason is the ultimate determining factor. So they believe that some of the Bible was revelation, which deists don't believe. They believe that some of the Bible was revelation, but they determined by their own reason which parts of the Bible mattered. So Jefferson, as I said, believed most of the Gospels, but jettisoned the rest of the New Testament and decided that was irrational. Franklin... People will say, well, Franklin, when he was 17 years old, said he's a deist. Yeah, he did. And then about two pages later in his autobiography, he said a lot of this is irrational, and he jettisoned it. He got rid of it. But he didn't go all the way to Christianity. He just went into this middle category somewhere. But it's fundamentally the trumping element. Sorry to use the word trump. The trumping element is reason. They were rationalists. They were taught Enlightenment rationalism. Now, there's different kinds of Enlightenment rationalism. They were taught the English version, not the French version, or they had really been crazy. But they were taught English rationalism, and they were theistic rationalists. And so they ultimately decided by what was seemed rational to them. That's why some of them believed in miracles and some of them didn't. Those who believed in miracles said it was rational that a present God would care about his creation and maybe interject at certain times in order to have a good effect. Others said it's irrational for a being who is perfect to set up a system and then fiddle with it or violate its principles. So it has to do with their education, and it also has to do with their own hubris. The last line of my book is, they created a god in their own image. You know how we always say, or people say, you know, God created us. Well, we say, because the Bible says, God created us in his image. They created God in their image, based on what they thought was rational.
I just have a question. How should we, as Christians, continue to be salt and light and not fall into a retreatist mindset and assume that Christ may come back tomorrow? So why should we do anything with our country?
Oh, very good. Why should we not have a retreatist mindset and just say Christ may come back tomorrow, so let's not do anything? Because Christ put us here to work, and he made us workers, according to Ephesians 2, when he saved us. And so we're to work, we're to do good things, we're to do, when I criticize them for saying, you know, Adams for saying that I'm a Christian because I do good things, I'm not criticizing doing good things, I'm criticizing thinking that makes you a Christian. We do good things because we're Christians, right? We're saved unto good works. So we do good works because we're Christians. We're here to work, we're here to do things, and we should. And I teach political studies. That's what I teach. So I think Christians ought to be involved in government. But you need to be involved in government with the right mindset, which is not to put all of your trust in government. And America is not a mess because we just need the right president. Or if we just get the right Supreme Court justice, then that'll solve everything. America's in a mess because of John chapter 3, verse 19, not 16, which is, men love the darkness. That's why America's in a mess, and the government can't change that. We can try and make things better, we can try and improve society, and we can promote morals and moralism, that's perfectly fine, but that's not the be-all and end-all. The be-all and end-all is the gospel.
Is that biblical? Do they come from God or do they come from law?
Okay, I'm going to offend the last person I haven't yet offended today. I don't see any rights in the Bible, unless you want to claim the right to eternal damnation. I just don't see rights in the Bible. I've been looking for 40 years because people keep saying they're there, and I don't see it. And so, no, I don't think that the Bible gives us rights. Maybe somebody could enlighten me. Somebody's going to go to the Ten Commandments and say, thou shalt not steal. That means you don't have a right to steal. It doesn't mean you have a right to have something. It just means you do have something. It's the Bible is about responsibilities, not rights, in my opinion.
Paul, when he was being, when he was beaten.
Yeah, he's talking there about rights that Rome gave him.
Right. He actually appeals to law, though.
Yeah,
he says, because I'm a Roman citizen.
Yeah.
He doesn't appeal to...
Which is Roman law. So he was appealing to rights that Rome gave him. So that if you're talking about rights that governments give you, those are really privileges. They're not rights because the government isn't supremely powerful. But nonetheless, if you want to talk, but you're talking about, you asked me about God giving rights. And I'm saying the Bible doesn't teach that.
Right.
Rome gave him rights, and so he was appealing. And it's perfectly fine for us to use the rights that our government gives us. In case that was murky there.
You hear that all the time, though, that they're from God, they're not from the law.
Yeah.
And we gain our rights uniquely in America. Because we acknowledge God.
And that's how Jefferson was artful in the way he wrote it. Because then you can't question them, right? They come from God, so you can't question it. Yeah.
It's probably going to be a quick question. In our lifetime or in Congress or the Senate, is there somebody you could point to that they have shown proof that you've heard them talk and whatever that you could say that they were truly a believer?
Well, that's not for me to say. I mean, we don't know. I will say this. a friend of mine wrote a book, and I talked with him, and he convinced me, some of you are going to be happy, he convinced me that Ronald Reagan was a believer. Jimmy Carter was the first presidential candidate in American history to claim to be born again. Remember that? He used the phrase, born again. Maybe he was a believer, I don't know. I didn't like his policies, but maybe he was a Christian. I don't know. I don't really try to make those evaluations because we don't really know. We don't know who in this room is a Christian. I mean, God knows. And so, but in terms of...
Was it true that Ben Franklin did put out all the religious paraphernalia with George Whitefield?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
Whitefield and Franklin, you saw the movie?
Yeah.
Whitefield and Franklin were good friends. One thing that apparently isn't in the movie, I talked to my friend who saw the movie and he didn't think it was there. Near the end of his life, Franklin said about Whitefield, and Franklin used to, Whitefield used to stay at Franklin's house they were good friends. And he said, my good friend George Whitefield always prayed, I'm going to paraphrase it, always prayed for my salvation, and he never got the satisfaction of believing his prayers were answered. So Franklin, again, turned it into kind of a joking thing.
Well, even what he has on his tombstone, he's going to be wormwood. I mean, worm food.
Yeah. Right behind you.
Is it Christian to be a part of a revolution?
Let me just say that, 2 months ago, I flew to Regent University in Virginia, part of their 250th anniversary thing, to engage in a debate on the question of whether the American Revolution was biblical. And I took the biblical side. It's very simple. No, I always have. Romans 13, verse 2. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. I mean, it's that simple. I mean, there's more to it, but it is fundamentally that simple. The Bible has 121 uses of the word rebel or revolt or some form of that word. All negative.
I might have misheard you. I thought you said you took the position that it was
biblical. Oh, I'm sorry. I took the biblical position to that question.
Okay.
Which is no, the American Revolution, okay. Or no revolution is biblical. I'm sorry.
That was unclear.
I've been going for an hour and a half, so I make a mistake. I always try to make one mistake every time so people don't get intimidated. No. I know, honey, I'm seeing the clock, but people, you can leave if you want to or pass the time. But no, the American Revolution was not biblical because it was a revolution. And revolutions are not biblical. So. But I'm very happy that it happened. And people say I'm inconsistent. And I say, well, then... You are upset that Jesus was crucified because part of what made that happen was Judas betraying him and him being unjustly crucified and whatnot. So you don't want your salvation. No, they're totally separate things. God uses man's wickedness to accomplish his purposes. And so God used the wickedness of the American Revolution to produce what I think is the greatest country in the history of the world, a country that's done more good than any country in the history of the world, aside from murdering 60 million of its children.
Could you argue from a principle of lex rex, as in the law is what governs, for kind of a backing for fighting against a system where the rights of that system were not being given?
No.
Okay.
Romans 13 was written to who? It's not a trick question. Written to who? The Romans. Where did the Romans live? Rome. The emperor of Rome, when Paul wrote Romans 13, was Nero. Nero was so bad, there's a school of theology that says he was the Antichrist. The school of theology that thinks everything's already being fulfilled, Nero was the Antichrist. He was not a good guy.
More what I'm getting at is that there was a sense in which what the British government was doing was breaking their own law.
Yeah, but they weren't. And that's the other thing you should read. I got an article. They weren't. They kept saying they were doing that, and then they kept saying it violated the British Constitution, but they couldn't mention anything in the British Constitution. That's why they switched. They switched from originally arguing their rights as Englishmen to natural rights, the rights of human beings, because they were asked to show us, and James Wilson, who's one of these guys, who was one of the first Supreme Court justices, James Wilson admitted that they couldn't actually find a thing that showed what the rights were that were being violated. It was no taxation without representation. They were represented under British system of representation. But the Americans had a different view of representation that wasn't the British system, and they imposed that and then said, we're not represented. But under the British system, now which one should you go by? The actual country, their laws, or some aberrant anti-governmental group that tells you the different thing? They were following the law of representation. Same thing with taxation. Most people don't know also that they never asked them to pay taxes other than to pay for the Stamp Act, and the other taxes were designed simply to pay for the forts that the British had on the border to protect the Americans. This is coming out of my ear. Also, by the way, there were 5 Americans that served in Parliament during that time. That's a little-known fact. Even AI doesn't know that. I Googled it, and the AI doesn't know. 5 Americans actually served in Parliament during that time, but the Americans, they met, and Franklin and James Otis and some others met to talk about whether they should seek representation. They decided they didn't want representation because they didn't want to pay the salaries of representatives that they would send over, and because they wouldn't have enough representatives, and so all it was going to do was take away their no taxation without representation argument. And so they decided not to officially have representatives. Yeah, those are brutal. That's when I started. That's why I said I had studied it for 30 years. I went and heard Peter Marshall when I was teaching high school, and he was at a high school thingy, Light and the Glory and whatnot. It's terrible. There's one segment, just to give you an example of their historiography, there was one segment in the book in which they say he and the other guy, David Manuel, were sitting on the porch talking about things, and then the wind blew open a passage, and so they knew the Holy Spirit was pointing. That's the kind of historiography they used. And he actually was Peter Marshall ended up the head of a cult as well. Most people don't know that.
Yeah, do you think Christians are obligated to work for change not through revolution but through the system that has been provided for them?
I don't think you're obligated to do so, but I think you can if you want to. I don't think there's any obligation for Christians to be involved in politics at all, but I think it's a good thing to do. This thing is not working. I think it's a good thing to do. I wouldn't teach political studies if I didn't think it was a good thing to do. Daniel, Joseph, they affected some really good things when they were in power.
So you say that some of the founding fathers were Christians. Does that mean that they're sinning by doing that?
Yes. If they supported the revolution, yeah, which some of them did.
Did Martin Luther and his revolution against the Roman Catholic system, was that also sin?
Did he take up arms and fight against the government, or did he take up a pen and argue against Catholicism. Those are two different things.
There's someone who's pretty popular, was pretty popular, who is claiming that the body politic of America was so Christian and so Protestant that the federal system cannot properly function if the population is no longer Christian. What would you say to that?
Well, obviously I would say that no, because it wasn't set up for that. It was, and they don't cite that in the Constitutional Convention. They cite Montesquieu. Montesquieu is the most cited person in the Constitutional Convention. They cite the ancient Romans. They learned a lot from the ancient Romans, especially about the legal system. In the Federalist Papers, they go... What about, you want to compare scripture, what they say in the Federalist Papers is the least fallible guide. The least fallible guide is experience. In other words, history. And they learn, that's why in the Federalist Papers they go into great detail about ancient republics, about the Roman Republic, about various Greek petty republics. Before the Constitutional Convention, James Madison spent months studying every government that he could find anything about in the history of the world. And they studied those, and they looked at what's good in it and what's bad in it. Let's try and do the good stuff and cut out the bad stuff, which is why they didn't do democracy, because there wasn't any good in it. And they chose a Republican form of government. I don't mean to be intimidating by being loud and stuff. I just get excited. So if you have a question, don't be intimidated. I'm not angry or anything. It gets my blood flowing. So it's like when I'm coaching football. Any other questions? Quite possibly so. And there's no question that the United States, that was part of God's plan, that the United States become a country. That's why I said God uses what Calvin called the instrumentality of the wicked. God uses the instrumentality. Or look at Genesis 50:20. What did Joseph say to his brothers? He said, "You meant it for evil. God meant it for good." God uses the wickedness of men, what they want to do, to accomplish his purposes, just like he used Judas and Pilate to accomplish the ultimate good for us, which is our salvation. But that doesn't make, it doesn't excuse what they did. What does he say about Judas? Be better if he had never been born, right? So the fact that somebody does something bad that has a good cause doesn't excuse them doing the bad thing. Romans 3:8, let us do evil that good may come. No. Paul says no. We don't believe in the end justifies the means. Even Machiavelli didn't believe that, contrary to popular opinion. Oh, yeah, it's too complicated to get into it. It's too complicated. The French were just crazy at the time, as the reign of terror illustrates, right? I'll follow our former pastor. What did Dr. MacArthur say in his last couple years of life? He said he was totally opposed to freedom of religion. I am too. God is opposed to freedom of religion. If not, he can't send anybody to hell. I talk about that in my book. Madison says, you know, that God establishes freedom of religion. Well, if that's the case, then if you have a right to believe whatever you want, which is what the documents say, that is God-given, if you have a God-given right to believe what you want, then God can't send you to hell. Because you had a right to believe whatever you wanted. And freedom of religion works out nicely again for us because it allows us to properly worship God. It also allows the vast majority of people to go to hell and worship themselves or worship Buddha or worship money or worship the country or whatever, and they go to hell. So I know that's controversial, but I don't agree with freedom of religion either. I like it for our, you know, in our circumstance, but it's not overall a good thing.
So I guess the question, because the alternative doesn't save anyone either when the government says you must be this. They're still not converted when that happens. So,
well, the alternative, I'm sorry. Ah, so it does work. It's worked in Israel. It'll work in the millennial kingdom. There won't be any freedom of religion in the millennial kingdom. There wasn't freedom of religion in the Mosaic Commonwealth. There wasn't freedom of religion in the Puritan society in New England when they landed either. They didn't give freedom of religion. I argue that's one reason to illustrate that they weren't Christian. I mean, they were Christians, but the country wasn't because, anyway. And the patriot preachers who spent a lot of time talking about freedom, you realize one of the loyalist preachers, my favorite one, pointed out that the Bible never talks about political freedom anywhere in the Bible. And all the passages that they were talking about in terms of freedom were about spiritual freedom, like Galatians 5, for example. In fact, there was one preacher, a patriot preacher, who had a 21-page sermon. He spent the first 9 pages talking about what Galatians 5 really says, which is freedom from sin, right? And spiritual freedom. And then he says, but now I switch to another topic, and he applies it to politics, to political freedom. And that's what they did. They applied passages about spiritual freedom I should have put this other slide on there to show you some of their abuses of scripture, which are embarrassing. So, for example, taste not, want not, you know, eat not, taste not, want not, whatever that passage is. Anyway, they took that as the Bible approving of their refusal to buy things from Great Britain. Or during the French and Indian War, they said that France was the beast in Revelation. And then during the American Revolution, they said Britain was the beast in Revelation. And when George III came to the throne, they said a new king arose that knew not Joseph. And it was, you shall know the truth, the truth shall set you free. That's, again, spiritual freedom. And I always quib with people when I'm talking with them, but that just means the spirit wasn't in the South, apparently. American South, get it? No freedom, never mind. The truth shall set you free. How many times have you heard people use that in any context they want, right? Whatever truth they want to talk about, like Bill Clinton and all these, and as if any truth sets you free. But that's not what it's talking about. It's talking about the truth of the gospel sets you free.
What do you think of that old phrase, where Princeton goes, so goes America?
Never heard it.
Oh, okay. I heard it from somewhere.
Don't know.
Christian ruler to
That's an interesting question. The Bible doesn't really talk about any rulers in that way, other than the rulers of Israel, and they were told in Deuteronomy 17, God laid out, Moses speaking for God, lays out in Deuteronomy 17, rule in that sense. And so not allow false religion, if that's what you're asking. But the assumption isn't that there's going to be a godly ruler over a godly society other than Israel until we get to the millennial kingdom. Wow, you guys are hanging in there. I talk about it all day long. Oh, you're welcome. Okie doke.